Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This week, we're going to talk about the fact that the last 10 years have brought a lot of change. And this change, some of it is positive, but some of it, perhaps at least from a retiree standpoint,
sure,
may not have been as good. And we're not telling you all anything you don't know. But we're talking about some of these changes that have taken place that, for the most part, relate to our ability to retire, the nature of our retirement, what it costs to retire, and how long that retirement might be.
Yeah, because it has changed in the last decade, how we retire.
It's almost as if we emerge from the Great Recession with a little bit of a different world.
Yeah.
We have interest rates that have hovered near zero for close to a decade.
Right.
We've had negative interest rates in Europe. I mean, so it's just a world that we've never experienced before. And economists would lead us to believe that they have a plan, and perhaps they do have a plan, but the point is it can't be based on any experience or empirical data or whatever.
And I think it's all made us much more cautious.
It has. And I think that we see that in youth today is this newest generation, Gen Z, I guess, that would just now be graduating college. They tend to be more conscious of budgeting, of saving money, oddly, than their parents, which I guess are millennials.
Right.
And I think that it's a generation that grew up hearing a lot about financial concern, you know, seeing it written in the conversations and the expressions on their parents' faces.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went through college thinking more about, can I get a job doing this? And taking a little more seriously the idea of making a living. All those are positive things, but the point is the world has never been the same since the Great Recession. And as a result, it means that planning, especially for retirement, means thinking more deeply about this new world. You can't approach those things that you would have had to attend to, the business of retirement and planning for the balance of your life, in the same way.
No. And the thing is, too, that retirees are living much longer. In fact, the CDC has pointed out if you make it to the age of 65, your life expectancy is about another 20 years.
And, you know, normally people thought, well, I'm going to retire and I'm going to live into my 70s. And maybe if I'm lucky, I'll live to 80, because those were the median survival rates. But now we know that realistically, somebody retiring at 65, easily 20 years.
Without a doubt.
And many people beyond that. So that's a different plan for how much money you have. And then compounding that is the fact that no longer are there guaranteed pensions, where your only fear was inflation. Used to, everyone assumed that what it meant to have retirement money was to have a pension, Social Security plus the company plan.
Right.
And the company plan may have had adjustments for retirement. Some didn't. But the point is, you knew that you have X amount of dollars coming in every month for the balance of your life. Now that's not the deal. The number of people with retirement plans have gone down dramatically. Those traditional pension plans, there were like 20% of the companies, private companies, this private sector, 20% in 2008. In 2009, we're down to 13%.
Is that right?
Yeah. So now we're looking at these 401ks, these tax-deferred sums of money that we have resting in bank accounts, securities accounts, various places, bonds, whatnot, because there are a lot of investments that are permitted for this tax-deferred status. And some people, the more sophisticated perhaps, are doing real estate investments. But the bottom line is you're on your own.
Okay.
And very few people can count on the income that's generated from that lump sum, wherever it's sitting, that they would have from a fixed amount of money that they were to receive per month.
And can you explain the difference between, say, a 401k and an IRA?
Well, let me first explain this difference. Some people don't understand why are all this fuss about 401ks IRAs, these ERISA plans. And these are assets that are a form of savings that allows you to have these special benefits. But these benefits come in different forms. So, for example, if you're talking about an IRA, that's typically going to be a plan in which you'll have tax deferred in terms of the money you put into it, so you don't pay on the front end. You don't pay your taxes, so it accumulates. And if you look at the math of what that does over 5, 10, 15, 20 years, this is the way to think about it, is in terms of tax rates. So if tax rates stayed exactly the same and you had a tax rate you could pay today, or you could wait and pay that tax in 20, 25 years. And let's assume that that tax, the amount that would have been taxed for that year's income is $50,000, which probably could be significantly more depending on your income. But
sure,
let's say $50,000. So what's really happening here is the government is saying, look, why don't you keep that $50,000 and you can earn money on it. So however much that accumulates on money, we'll let that be yours, and then you'll pay us that $50 later, or the $50,000 later in terms of taxes. And then there'll be tax, of course, on your earnings. But the point is, what you've really gotten is this free loan in which you're paying no taxes during that entire period of time, and then you're taxed when you pull it out. Now, a big point that I made then is the idea that tax rates stay the same. So that logic doesn't work if it turns out that your rates are a lot higher later on. And they could be higher for a couple reasons. It could be that the tax rates have changed.
Okay.
Or it could be that you're at a level of income at that point where suddenly you're in a higher bracket. You're taxed at a higher amount when
you
bring
the money
out. So
you're going to have to pay more.
So you'd pay more. So tax-deferred assets are marvelous. Now, let me distinguish, though, the Roth IRA, because that's the distinction most people struggle
with.
Yeah,
that confuses me.
Well, the deal there is especially attractive if you could look into the future and foretell that, yeah, there's going to be this increase in tax rates, because then you would go ahead, pay the tax today, get it out of the way, and so you've paid taxes on that income. Now the deal is you get to let it accumulate, and then when you draw it out 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the road, you don't pay any taxes when you draw it out.
You do it on the front end?
You do it on the front end.
Okay.
And you're paying, of course, on that smaller amount. So let's say that you put $100,000 in on the front end. You pay taxes of $30,000. So you have $70,000 left. Well, everything that $70,000 earns over all those years, and when you take it out, you're taking it out without taxation. So it's a marvelous benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So people... It's safe to say that among the first things that anybody should do, any working person should do, would be to max out on their tax-deferred opportunities for saving, even without matching, but certainly with matching. And many employers provide matching. But even without matching, it's such a marvelous deal that why not take advantage of that first, and then you move on with your other dollars that you might have to invest or save elsewhere.
So you recommend a Roth IRA?
I'm pretty cynical about tax rates being higher in the future. Yeah. For the most part, I lean more toward if somebody has an option, it doesn't apply to everyone. I'd have to know more about each individual. But as a general statement, yeah, I think a Roth makes more sense today than a traditional IRA. In other words, you pay the taxes on the front end. So you're betting on some things happening in the future that that I think it's pretty fair to expect. I think taxes are likely to go up. I think what Trump did last year was a marvelous thing. I think it was
right.
It was a huge engine of growth for the economy. But I don't think it's going to last. I think that whether Trump is reelected or not, I think that the time's coming when that will change. And maybe it'll be postponed. But I think that there are too many ideas about how to spend money and too many programs that have been advocated for there not to be additional tax dollars required.
You know, it's also important, what they're going to do when they're retired, how active they're going to be.
Yeah, and that will affect whether they're going to draw on those funds more directly or not. And I know that some people's intention is to continue working. So they're thinking, yeah, we want to accumulate this retirement nest egg, but we expect to continually add to it or to take as little from it as possible. But, you know, you just can't predict whether your health will allow you to do that.
That's the thing.
Yeah. And some people don't want to do that, meaning that they it's not that they don't want to be active, but having a part-time job ties you down.
Right.
It means you can't travel when you want. It's a little like you know, having a full-time job in the sense that maybe you're not spending the number of hours each day there, but you're staying in that local city. You still can't leave the way that you would like. You're still tied down to a responsibility that you weren't. That perhaps you didn't envision being part of your retirement.
And sure, like say you take a job being the greeter at the local Walmart store.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to necessarily have the flexibility of just working when you want and not working, say, on holidays.
Yeah.
Because we all know Walmart's open on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah, I mean, a lot is – that's a good example. And we think of these examples that we hear of retirees who get these part-time jobs – but they seem to all have in common pretty much that you have to be willing to live on a schedule. Employers want their part-time employees to be on a schedule.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of retirees struggle with is this is their chance to go and stay with family when they want, to travel places they want to go.
Go away for the weekend if they want to.
To learn and go, yeah. And I think learning is big too, I find, with a lot of retirees that we know is people who they love to go on these nature outings. They
yeah.
like to take educational cruises or trips. Maybe I should say discovery cruises or trips. The point is that they have some dimension where there's a cultural opportunity or a historical opportunity associated with it. So if retirees want to be engaged in that way and have the time and opportunities to do that, it's difficult to do it with much of a standard employment, whether it's part-time or full-time.
That's true. That's true. And if you're just tuning in to Elder Talk, we're talking about how retirement has changed within the past decade. Now, isn't it true that CDs and bonds aren't paying as much for retirees?
Well, that's part of the issue. I mean, it's one of the reasons that this retirement lump sum is often not enough. Is, you know, there was a survey done in 2009, in which people were asked what did they think would be necessary for them to retire. And at that time, more than a substantial majority, between closer to 60%, felt that $1 million would be more than enough. They felt comfortable with that.
I could say that, sure.
The same question was asked this year, 2019, and substantially less. I don't remember the exact number, but is it like in the low 40s or so thought that would be adequate? And that's good reasoning because, as you point out, things have changed with interest rates. And so if $1 million with interest rates available at 4 or 5% and a more historic number, believe it or not, it's closer to 6%. But if let's say it's 5%, that's $50,000 a year. And for some people, that's very realistic. What about when rates fall to 2% or below, as they have? Then suddenly you're looking at $20,000 a year off $1 million. Now, if you're going to invade the principal, that's a different discussion. And then that is sort of triggers what some people have heard of called the 4% rule.
Yes.
The 4% rule, which many people talk about in terms of retirement planning.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, it's actually a handle that was developed by financial planners and others over the past 30 years, and it held true for a long time. I think it was originally developed in the early 60s, and it held true for many years. But now we're in a different environment where interest rates are far below what they've ever been. And so now whenever you say if somebody's going to live what could be 25 or plus years in retirement or with substantially reduced income, and you think the 4% rule allows them to do that, which is really the idea that it doesn't assume that all of your money is just coming from income. It assumes that part of the money is being funded from going into principal. So it's a combination of interest and principal. Think about what a mortgage does. It's kind of a reverse mortgage where you know, you start out the mortgage and over time you contribute almost all interest and then very little principal.
To the principal, sure.
And then over time, more principal, more principal, more principal.
It's where you have equity built up in the home.
So that same principle is at work whenever you're talking about this 4% rule. It's the idea that over time, as you pull out, part will be most of it will be earnings early on. Very little will be principal. But over time, more will be principal. Less will be earnings.
Right, right.
And the whole idea is that you kind of run out of money, you know, just close to your death. And the 4% rule was a pretty reliable mechanism in an environment where you where the standard rates of interest that you could earn on AAA bonds were 4, 5, even 6%. So it's a very different world. And another thing that's different now when you're doing calculations like that, and this is kind of a mathematical thing, but it's not complicated if you think about it. So let's assume that that interest rate that, that you're investing in a stock market. So let's assume the stock market goes up. Say it goes up 10%.
Okay.
Then that's a great thing. You can say, gee, if I had $500,000 in my savings that I'm accumulating for retirement, or maybe I'm in retirement, so now it's worth $550,000. That may affect your earnings depending on the type of account you have. But now let's assume the reverse occurs, which we all know regularly. There are relatively wide swings in the Standard & Poor's index as well as in other market indexes, the Dow, et cetera. So that swing now, let's assume it goes down 10%. So now you go from $500,000 to $450,000. So you think, okay, then I just need it to go back up 10%. Well, no, 10% of $450,000 would not get you to $500,000.
No, of course not.
So that when you think about the math of how that affects your savings over time, people who count on compounded earnings in a stock market where you have fairly wide fluctuations in value will find that that number won't work over certain periods of time. Now, people who are fans of stock market investment will correctly point out that, gee, you know, over 30 years, they'll choose large blocks of time where it's clear that over that period of time, yes, people who put money in, kept it in, it was advantageous to them. But when you pull out windows of time, and that's more descriptive of perhaps people's circumstances in retirement, they're in windows that could be as long as, say, 15 or 20 years, or they could be significantly less. But the point is they're having to pull money out. So whenever your market is down and you're trying to recover from this swing downward in the market, maybe it's not a full bear market, but just things have swung down, kind of like this happened recently in the last week or so in this market, then you're taking money out. So you're worsening your ability to recover from this downturn. So swings in market value are especially hard on people. This sort of fluctuation is especially hard on people who are having to continually take out money. The argument that you place your money in the market and it's the best place for it to be long term really works for those people, number one, who have a long term. And they know they have a long term, meaning younger people, and also people who are not having to pull money out along the way. But when you're pulling money out because you have to pay your taxes, pay your rent, food expenses, day-to-day living, when you have to pull it out like that, depending on when and where the market is at that particular time, it can devastate your ability to recover.
And you know another thing, most people, you know, it's always been where when they retired, their home was paid for. That's not always the case today. So they're even after retirement, they still may have that mortgage for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And that can affect their retirement. That may mean the difference between actually retiring or working longer or retiring and getting that part-time job as we talked about.
Yeah, people who find themselves going into retirement with a mortgage, they do have an additional bite into their income each month. But I will say this, though, is that at least rates have been so much lower in recent years. Now, they swung up a little bit for a while, and then in the past few years, they've been swinging back down, this year especially. So for the most part, it's been a pretty hospitable environment in terms of interest rates, historically speaking. So at least they have that going for them. But of course, we would hope that they're fixed rates. You know, even though I know I have friends and others, many of you probably know people, perhaps you have had variable rates. And it's been a bet that has paid for the last 25 years. You know, if somebody listened to me, I would have been saying 25 years ago, no, rates can swing way up. I'm going to stick with fixed rates. So you pay an additional point and a half, maybe even 2 points in order to get that fixed rate. And meanwhile, your friends go ahead and take the gamble, and they get a variable rate mortgage, and rates have never gone up in the last 25 years significantly.
Right.
So, you know, what do I know? But the point is, I think for somebody going into retirement, I think they really don't want to live with that risk.
No.
I think they want a fixed rate. It's probably better to pay the additional 1 to 1.5%.
And you know what else is happening? I think what's changed retirement too is grandparents are, you know, serving as ATM for their grandchildren, you know, helping to pay for their college. And we know the cost of college. You know, we're talking $30,000 a year in tuition.
Yeah. I don't know how this happened, that suddenly grandparents became a source of support more for grandkids than I think they have the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Now, I'd be curious to get some of your ideas as you think about your role as a grandparent. Do you find that you're giving more money than perhaps you otherwise would have, or maybe than you received from your grandparents?
Mm-hmm.
Now, my grandparents were pretty generous. I don't know. I think that's common.
Yeah, for the most part.
But what I'm reading about now and what I'm seeing is grandparents are stepping up to pay portions of college expenses.
Yeah.
They're providing money to kids that are in their early 20s, maybe shouldn't mm-hmm. be receiving any money from the grandparents especially. So that is a factor. I think that grandparents really want to be helpful to their kids, a noble motive.
Oh, sure.
One to be applauded, but maybe one not to be encouraged.
Yeah, because we're talking a significant amount of money. I mean, like I said, average college tuition per year is $30,000, and you multiply that by 4.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing, of course, if they can afford it, you know, go to it. It's a marvelous thing. My intention when I have grandkids is to lavish things on them. But the point is, if money's tight, that impulse can really interfere with a grandparent's self-sufficiency if they live long lives in retirement.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering why that is, why parents aren't the ones, you know, solely providing that source.
I don't know. That may get into generational things.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not sure what the explanation is for that. But, yeah, I think that grandparents have just become more prominent in terms of sources of funds.
And not just with colleges. Maybe helping with a granddaughter's wedding or even a grandson's wedding, or helping to buy that first car for the grandchild, or maybe, you know, putting a down payment on a house for their grandchild.
I mean,
there's all types of, you know, funding that they do and provide.
Yeah. Down payments for houses, that's huge. So I don't know the explanation for it, but these, clearly as we talk about the things we've been covering here, we can see that retirement is a little more tricky to plan and to pull off well, because in part of this blessing that we can expect to live longer, but also because we live in an economy and an economic environment in which we've never lived before. So I would argue we can't trust it, and we don't know what direction fully it's going to go. Meanwhile, your opportunities to earn income on your assets are very low. So that may be good for stock market valuation, but it may be bad for a retirement plan.
Mm-hmm. And like we've talked before, you just can't predict the future. You don't know what your health is going to be like.
So let's do this. Let's take a break. Let's come back. Do we have our roving celebrity reporter available today?
Oh, we certainly do. And I can't wait. He's got a great segment lined up for us.
Okay. So we'll be back in a minute then with our roving reporter, Dan.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
Okay. We're back with our roving celebrity reporter, Dan, so you have a story for us, something in the news relating to the pitfalls of estate planning. And
what a story it is.
Yes, it is quite the story. The story starts out in 2013 when real estate millionaire John Shockless was found having been shot in his Connecticut home. Now, there's a lot of mystery surrounding his death. But his family and heirs standed to inherit $44 million total
mm-hmm.
in his estate. Now, $7 million of that going to one of his daughters, Linda, and he had also shared an account with his grandson, Nathan Carman.
So wait now. So he had multiple daughters.
Yes. Four daughters total.
Okay. Four daughters and $44
million. $44 million.
And Linda, one of his daughters, gets seven.
Seven, yes.
And she has a son.
She has a son named Nathan. Yes.
All right.
He is a teenager during the course of this.
Okay.
Now, he had been diagnosed with Asperger's and had spent some time in a mental health facility receiving psychiatric treatment, as
it were. He became delusional, from what I understand.
Delusional. He had been very accusatory toward principals and secretaries and just authority figures within the school.
So he was diagnosed also with paranoid delusions, right?
Yes, paranoid delusions was the diagnosis. Now, there were some questions regarding his involvement in the death of his grandfather that time.
But he was never charged with that, was he?
Never charged with anything. He was questioned extensively by the police at the time. However, he was unable to really find – like they couldn't substantiate any of their claims regarding his involvement in the death. It was always very suspicious.
But what things were suspicious?
Well, he had recently purchased a gun that just so happened to have gone missing after the murder.
And he was 16 at the time?
He was a teenager. I think there was some discrepancy regarding his age. I believe he might have been of age.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. That would have made – yes. Now, the gun had gone missing. The bullet fragments recovered from the murder could have matched the rifle that had gone missing, and the GPS and hard drive of his computer mysteriously were disposed of during the course of this this time frame.
And so this gun, though, disappears.
Yes.
And it was supposedly the type of gun that would have shot or
yes.
did shoot his –
And the computer, that's suspicious.
Very suspicious.
But the only way he would have been a beneficiary at that stage would have been indirectly through his mother, or maybe he thought through some other way, through his relationship with his grandfather. So take us to the next stage. I'm getting you bogged down at this stage. So what happens next?
This stage is also has one other wrinkle to it. He and his mother and his grandfather had a joint bank account for $400,000 at the time that he had just as much access to as his grandfather and mother. So
he must have been on the bank account, at least as a permitted signer.
Yeah. Now, okay. this is something that he'll use in future parts to this case that, hey, I had nothing to do with it. This was my grandfather. He gave me this account. He had given me an internship in his company. Now, his grandfather called it a senior project manager. But the next step to this is in 2016 when he and his mother, Linda, who was 54 years old, at the time he was 22, 23, they went on a boat ride. And the boat is called the Chicken Pox.
Wow.
Yes. Okay. What a name for the boat.
The Chicken Pox.
Yes. They go on a boat ride to Rhode Island in a 31-foot family fishing boat, and they're going fishing. The boat had received improper repairs, allegedly according to court documents and according to his testimony regarding the state of the repairs. The boat began taking on water and sank. The mother was never seen again. The mother and son were separated during the course of the sinking, and the son managed to get to the life raft and was found 8 days later in pretty good shape.
Right. And I remember seeing this on Dateline, and he was in very good shape. He wasn't sunburned. He wasn't dehydrated like you would think someone would be if they were, you know, 8 days on the sea.
And given where he was claiming to have been, there are coastal experts regarding waves and such that said he couldn't have been there without actively trying to be where they found him.
Yeah, meaning he had some power to maneuver the boat.
Yes.
And or perhaps the sinking occurred. elsewhere. Let me ask you about these defects in the repair. So this guy personally, the grandson, he personally did the repairs on the boat. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there were holes in it, and he patched them.
Four of them.
Four holes.
Four holes he patched with epoxy.
Okay. And this was a 31-foot boat, wasn't it?
Yes.
I mean, so this is not a rowboat.
No.
This is – and it's called a fishing boat, but a 31-foot boat is a pretty good-sized boat.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it true that he had been around boats all his life and he was an expert?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, his family owned significant real estate alongside the water. It stands to reason. He had been around boats all his life, and they had owned boats and all
right.
sorts of aquatic
things.
Things, yeah.
Things when, you know, living a life on the sea
yeah.
or access
yeah.
the sea. So this kid, his story, though, is that that he didn't see his mother after this boat started sinking, that she disappeared and he couldn't save her.
Yeah. They could not – for whatever reason, he could not save her.
Okay.
Which that's
– possible.
Possible.
It is possible.
I don't doubt that.
I wouldn't go that far. But anyway.
No. So. I'm saying if he had nothing to do with, you know
– it's conceivable.
It's conceivable.
Yes. Okay. You know. So then the effect of this, though, is that he stands to inherit, I guess, this what?
$7 million.
$7 million.
Plus whatever was in the account, the $400,000 that he had shared with his mother.
Whatever was left
yeah,
of that $400,000.
Exactly.
Hmm. So now were law officials or law enforcement, were they suspicious?
Yes, quite suspicious. The investigation is still going because no body has been found. So she hasn't been
declared dead.
And no charges have ever been filed against this young man.
No charges filed. A lot of investigation, a lot of questioning. Grand jury testimony as it stands right now is between him and the insurance company because he wants $85,000 to replace the boat.
To replace the boat, the chicken pox.
So he made what might be a strategic mistake of filing an insurance claim.
Yes.
Because that's going to bring out
investigators.
Red flags. Yeah.
Yes.
So he did. He filed that. He was denied.
He was denied and he is refiling it.
Okay. So the law enforcement, though, since – I mean this occurred in – what, 2016 was when this boat sank?
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So here we are 3 years later, and obviously there's not enough proof to bring him to trial since he's not been brought to a criminal trial,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But yet there's still investigation. I'm not hopeful that this would produce anything after 3 years, are we?
Yeah. Well, and there's another thing, too. This young man really didn't have any companions, any friends, and apparently his mother and the grandfather – were his only companions. So it leaves you to think, why would he off them?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, $7 million is a pretty good motivation, but...
You know, it could be just an incriminating coincidence that he's last with his grandfather before he dies, that now is murdered. He's last with his mother before she mysteriously disappears.
Right.
Could the mother not swim?
Well, I think they were significantly off the coast.
I know, but I'm saying he swam to this boat, to this raft, but could she swim?
I think she could swim. I think the bigger – like.
But you got to imagine when a boat's taking on water, the waves, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, there were some questionable circumstances, let's just say, regarding the sinking and who got to what – to the life raft and who didn't, you know.
But I just think that assuming she could swim, mm-hmm. and we'll assume that, if this boat sunk in a storm, I get it. When you hear of sometimes these boats taking in water suddenly and this cataclysmic storm develops.
Right.
So people who are caught in the boat don't get out. But when you have a boat that's slowly sinking – in what I consider is normal weather, mm-hmm. maybe even a sunny day, you would think that the mother could have swam to this raft. because it wasn't the circumstances that we often hear of where boats sink in a storm.
Where it was chaos.
Yeah, mm-hmm. chaos and high waves and all that.
It's very suspicious.
What is there a lesson here? I'm looking for the and this is on me to figure out.
Yes.
What is the
Don't
lesson?
Don't go on a boat called the chicken pox.
Yes, there's that, and then there's also the wrinkles of Linda's sisters are attempting to stop him from inheriting.
And the Slayer statute.
Yes.
Let me talk just a second about that. And I think you're going to check what it applies in that particular state. But a Slayer statute is a statute that exists in virtually all the states. And it says that you cannot inherit money if you played a role in somebody's death. And it doesn't require that there be a criminal finding. Almost every state does not require that it be beyond a reasonable doubt, meaning that of a criminal conviction. It can be that you're civilly – I mean as in O.J.'s case, I think.
Right.
Was one. So you can be civilly held guilty, meaning a more likely than not standard, which is typical for any non-criminal case. And that's enough to make you disqualified. In this case, there's not been either of those, a criminal or a civil ruling yet. Unless that would have been the case with the insurance, and I don't think that's what they found. They just did an investigation and denied it. Mm-hmm. Maybe. So now let's go to what do you know the specifics of the statute? And we're talking about what's Connecticut's
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Right. So the mother's disappearance falls under the state of New Hampshire's jurisdiction. As it stands, the common law approach employs a constructive trust. So it compels an individual who obtains a property interest by unjust, unconscionable, or unlawful means to convey that their interest to whom it justly belongs. Basically, if it were to be found out that he had been the cause of this boat sinking and as a result the death of his mother, he would not inherit.
So is this called a Slayer statute in that state, or is it just – it sounds like a rule that exists generally, and their legislature may not have felt a need to pass a Slayer statute because they felt they already had the authority under what's called, as you described, this constructive trust. It's a mechanism where courts have what they call equity authority, meaning the ability to do fairness. And whenever they see something – in an estate, especially where somebody obtains property that appears to be, you know, just a shock on the sense of justice of the court or whatnot or unconscionable, then they have the ability to right that wrong. Mm-hmm. And they may have felt that the legislature in New Hampshire that they don't need a Slayer statute. They're good with what they have. So this is going to be an issue if these three aunts. These three surviving aunts, who I suspect are probably not feeling very warm and close to this nephew. So apparently they suspect he's guilty.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, and they're estranged from him. There's, from what I understand, there's no contact.
Right. They attempted to include their father's death in this boat insurance case, but were denied by the judge. So the insurance company wanted to bring forth these aunts as further evidence of like, hey, this goes back even further. This was pre-planned. This was premeditated. But the judge denied that, and they decided to approach the case solely by the boat.
Yeah. See, that's not surprising where somebody in a trial wants to bring in a suspicious incident that occurred before. But often you can't show – the relevance, and that's the issue, is I'm sure that the lawyers representing this man allege that it wasn't relevant. And
relevance, because criminal charges weren't filed?
Well, they have to prove its connection. They would have to show that there's a pattern of behavior, and that was never established that this guy was murdered. So you can't start with the assumption he was murdered and then say, because he was murdered and we have the same person involved, this is a pattern. If he had been murdered, it would be. And you could say it's relevant if it had been established. But
right.
And I guess it was established the guy was murdered, but it wasn't
right.
Established this kid had anything to do with it. So I'm not surprised that a judge would rule that we're not going to allow any of that to get before the jury because we it's not established that the kid had anything to do with the previous. So it can be a difficult case. This could be that this kid is either very cunning or just through a very unlikely train of events, ends up with this.
Bad luck.
Yeah, bad plus good luck.
Well, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. This mixed blessing, I should say.
At the very least, he lost his mother and grandfather. That's pretty sad.
But the fact that those closest to him seem to suspect him makes you think that this may not be simply coincidental.
No.
But, you know, it.
But sometimes your own family members can be your worst enemy, and especially when you're talking about millions of dollars involved. So.
Yeah, you want, if you're wealthy and you have grandkids who have any tendencies that you suspect like this at all, you want to be sure they're familiar with this thing called the Slayer statue.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can plan through trust. There's lots of things you can do to protect your estate. But in a case like this, while these laws that exist in all the states – you know, will prevent somebody, a wrongdoer, from taking the share they would otherwise have had, it has to be established, at least more likely than not, that they're, in fact, that person. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to plan when you have difficult beneficiaries in more ways than one, not just in this very extreme case, but in other cases where you suspect that they're going to be inclined to create problems when you pass away. Often you can have covenants in your will or in your trust that say that if they attempt to break it, that they forfeit. They're called interim clauses.
Right.
That's not uncommon when you think somebody's going to misbehave with the estate
mm-hmm.
after you're gone. So there are various things that you can do to help lock things down. But something like this, it's very difficult.
This is a whole different level.
Yeah. So maybe there's not a lesson here for all of us in this particular case, but I have to tell you, it's an interesting story, and it's interesting to speculate about what are the facts.
Yeah, and how it's going to play out.
Absolutely.
Will this young man ever be charged to these – well, we know there was one crime.
Maybe two. Yeah, the statute of limitations doesn't expire on murder,
no.
but the longer you get from the first death, it appears less and less likely,
yeah.
unless there's a point at which he's incentivized to do a confession because he's already convicted of a more recent crime. So there are sometimes deals struck to encourage that sort of thing so that other police departments can close their books.
Mm-hmm.
And there may not be any disincentive. There may, in fact, be an incentive for him to admit to another murder. So we will see over time. We can count on our roving reporter to keep your antennas to the ground in this case.
Always.
Always. Well, this has been another episode of Elder Talk. Hope this was entertaining and informative. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.